Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. Mid-November is usually grant writing season for astrophysicists, as one of the big grants we apply for every year is the Astronomy and Astrophysics Grant solicited by the National Science Foundation, or NSF-AAG. These days, since now both NASA and the NSF have been significantly defunded, the task of writing a grant proposal can often seem pointless, as very few grants will probably even be awarded this year. Nevertheless, we all still apply, just in case. This year, I was a part of two grant proposals, one to build better models to compute the observable consequences of shockwaves moving close to the speed of light, and another to make predictions for the remnants of supernovae hundreds of years after they explode. It can be an exhausting task, writing grant proposals and getting all the documents needed in exactly the right format, and it can feel especially taxing when there is such a low probability of success. But we do it for our students, to make sure they can get paid to do the great research they do on the way to getting their PhD. I hope that one day NASA and the NSF will get their funding restored, making it just a little bit easier to pay our students. But we'll keep submitting our grant proposals regardless, telling the public about the great research we would like to do, even if we never get the funding. In astrophysics, we have theorists and we have observers. The theorists calculate what we think happens out there in the universe, and the observers look and see whether the theory is right. Actually, it's usually the other way around. The observers discover all kinds of new phenomena, and the theorists try to make calculations and build models to make sense of what the observers saw. For example, a few episodes ago, we talked with Dr. Emil van Tuff, an observer who directly images protoplanetary disks to learn about the environments in which planets form. Each protoplanetary disk represents the birth of an entirely new solar system. On the other hand, what does a theorist do to study planet formation? Oftentimes, the deceptively short answer is we put this solar system on a computer, calculating how a protoplanetary disk forms and evolves over the first million or so years of a solar system's lifetime. Of course, there's a great deal involved in such a calculation. That's why today we'll be talking with Dr. Caitlin Kratter, professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. I first met Dr. Kratter over a decade ago when I was still a graduate student. She has an incredible ability to deconstruct an idea into its most basic physics principles in real time, and I've gotten many of my best ideas just by having a conversation with her. We'll talk with Dr. Kratter about just what it takes to build a solar system on the computer. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast.
Don't feel like you. I try to avoid. I do a lot of interrupting, in general in life. but I try to avoid people doing their like public talk like as a monologue. You know.
Yeah, so, sure.
Feel free to just be. You know, say it however, whatever first way comes into your head. Okay. Are you ready to get started?
Yeah.
Okay. Great.
That's fine.
Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Caitlin Kratter, who's a professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. Dr. Kratter, thank you for joining me on my podcast.
Thanks for having me here. It's great to see you.
It's great to see you, too. So I feel like we've encountered each other various epics in my your face has like appeared over and over like periodically in my time from grad student to faculty
and slowly and aging like, and slowly every time.
But I remember the first time I met you, and that was when I was still a grad student at NYU, and my advisor was on a sabbatical at the Harvard Center for Astrophysics.
Yes.
And you were, I guess, a postdoc there.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't remember what I gave a talk at probably Lars Hernquist group meeting or something.
It was a TAP theory talk. We had a, not TAP, ITC theory talk.
Maybe. It was very informal, so it felt like a group meeting.
Maybe it was Lars group meeting.
But anyway, I remember you were in the audience asking me the scariest questions.
No.
Well, as a grad student, I was, you know, a little bit... That's just my interpretation of it. But, like, you know, it was also just a very... it's the first time I'd ever been to Harvard, so it was a very...
The culture there amongst the postdocs was to, you know, attempt to demonstrate one's value by asking informed and pointed questions.
Right, it was
a bit of a culture issue, perhaps.
But it was it was very fun. And also, I will say, in my experience knowing you, I think every time I run into you, at some point in the conversation, you say something that sticks in my head and it turns into a really good idea that I have that later on, like, you know, over a few years. So, so let me start by asking you, we're going to start by talking about you and how you got into science. So first, where did you grow up?
I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, so about 15 minutes from the airport.
Okay, I didn't realize that. So what was it like growing up in the Bay Area?
Well, this was pre-Silicon Valley, at least when I started. Mm-hmm. So it was not quite the epicenter of technology that it is today, but it was a pretty standard suburban lifestyle just outside of the city, I would say.
Okay. And so what, can you remember, like, have a memory of the first time you got interested in science?
So my first astronomy memory is either true or implanted, but of seeing Halley's Comet.
Oh, okay.
So I was very, very young. I guess I was 3 years old or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I have a memory of standing out on a field in the cold, you know, being told to look through a telescope and not seeing anything because, of course, 3 year olds can't look through telescopes. And I think in reality it was actually quite cloudy.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure I didn't actually see it, but I looked up into the sky when Halley's Comet was supposed to be there.
Right.
So that's my first astronomy memory. And I think in retrospect, it was something that was always fascinating to me, even if as a kid I didn't realize that it was an underlying passion. And I say that because I was pretty into like theater and mm-hmm. dance and music as a kid.
Okay.
And so for a while that was, that was a focus. But, you know, if I look back, I also was really into doing the science fair, not in astronomy, but I really loved the science fair.
So a casual observer might have thought, would not expected you to be on a science track.
I think that's right. But I always really, liked math and physics because I felt that they were more challenging than mm-hmm. other subjects. And so, in some ways you might say, well, I did the thing that was hardest, necessarily the right decision. But I remember, as an adult, like going back through some random box of stuff that my, parents had saved, and I found a cutout from the San Jose Mercury with images of the pillars of creation from Hubble in the mid-90s. I don't know if you remember this. It's this very famous image mm-hmm. from before they fixed the CCD, so it's got that weird stair-step pattern.
Oh.
And I had cut out this article. It's like, I don't remember having done it, but obviously it struck me enough at the time. So things like that made it clear that it was always always kind of lurking in the background.
Okay. You mentioned briefly your parents a little bit. What did they do?
They were both lawyers, but not mm-hmm. litigators. They worked in like financial services companies. So,
okay.
I never wanted to do what they did. And what's odd is that while, in some ways you say, I came from a, pretty well-educated family.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the reason I didn't think about being a scientist explicitly as a young kid is like, I don't really think I understood that it was a job.
Right.
Which seems ridiculous. Like I had, I went to a good school. I had great science teachers. Like I said, I did science fair projects. And it wasn't until I was in college that I realized that physics and astronomy was a career. I think I knew there were doctors and like chemists or something,
right.
but I didn't understand that this was a job.
Yeah, I mean, I know. I remember as a kid, like being good at math and like just I remember it's like doing fun math problems, and I thought like that's not really a job though. Like who would pay me to just sit around doing fun math problems all day?
Right, exactly. Like it was not until I was in college that when I actually got offered a job that paid to do science research, I was like, oh wait, someone's gonna pay me to do this stuff? Like this is amazing.
That's cool. So so then that's interesting. So then do you feel like, I guess college kind of opened that up, that idea for you, or?
Yeah, for sure. So I was a undergraduate at Barnard College, which is the women's college that's part of Columbia University.
Right.
And I had gone to New York because I was really into theater.
Oh.
And But I was in college and I was like, well, I don't want to waste my time studying something like theater in college. Like, if I'm going to do it, I'll do it outside of school or, you know, whatever. Uh-huh. So I should do something useful. I guess I'll try to add some science major. And I walked into a physics and astronomy minors meeting. I had just taken an astronomy class and was taking the physics sequence for, at that point, just for science credit. Mm-hmm. And this guy, Dr. Charles Liu, who at the time was working at the American Museum of Natural History, came into the majors and minors meeting and he was like, hey, does anybody want an internship at the museum over the summer? We pay. And I was like, I want a job. I want to stay in New York for the summer. I don't want to go home. And then I got a job starting to do, you know, research projects at the museum. And it was just this transformational experience for me. And I was like, okay. After that, I was like, I basically gave up on doing theater at all. And I was like, okay, this is what I'm going to do because it's fun. It seems like I'm kind of good at it and people are willing to pay. And the people involved are way nicer than the people I'm encountering doing theater outside of school. It's like a much better community of human beings to deal with.
That's kind of cool that Charles Liu kind of opened that up, and then from then on you became an astrophysicist.
I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, the museum was really transformational, and at the time, you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson was there as well, and he was on his way to being very famous, but not so famous enough that he wouldn't like hang out with random undergrads who were there. So, you know, I remember having very interesting conversations with him just like in passing in the hall. Mm-hmm. And so I feel really privileged to have had the opportunity to interact with him in that informal capacity before he was, you know, too big to bother with the likes of me.
Yeah, that's very cool. So then you finished your bachelor's degree at Barnard, and then where did you go to grad school?
I went to the University of Toronto.
Okay. And so for grad school, I guess that's when most people really learn how to be a scientist.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And so what would you say, like, I mean, thinking about grad school, what would you say, like, was the thing you learned, like, the skill or the thing that you learned in the process of becoming a scientist that, like, helped you the most?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think maintaining curiosity and excitement about, you know, almost any subject.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that has sustained me as a scientist going forward. I remember the neat thing about the program in Toronto, and one of the reasons I went there, is that they had this sort of series of projects that you do as a graduate student. I think people often think of graduate school as you think of one thing and you think of nothing else for five or six years.
You do this very narrow track and you just make a tiny improvement on this one thing. Yeah.
So in their program, you have to do two different things first before you choose a thesis. And I really liked that idea because at the time I didn't know what it was I wanted to work on. I had not done that much as an undergraduate. And so, you know, I had, you know, some research experience and some topics, but I had no idea really what I wanted to do. And so I liked that. And what I remember was I was trying to talk to different faculty about projects to work on. Mm-hmm. And I walked into the office of the guy who would then become my advisor, Chris Matzner, and he just started talking to me about dust. And dust in the interstellar medium. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I at the time was like, dust, really? It's not that exciting. But Chris was so excited about what he was talking about. He was just so enthusiastic. And if you would ask me before I walked in his door, do I want to think about dust? The answer was like, definitely not. But, you know, I was thinking like, oh, maybe I want to do some cool cosmology and understanding general relativity, you know, well, maybe making some progress in that. I mean, something like kind of ridiculous, right? And he was just so excited. And I was like, you know, man, this guy's like really excited about this. And I think I just want to work with somebody who's that enthusiastic. And that has like been the go-to advice I've given graduate students going forward, is like, don't worry so much about what the topic is. Mm-hmm. You know, make sure you can find someone to work with who shows that level of engagement. Because if you have a sort of good scientific mind, I think you can get engaged with almost any topic
in detail. I totally agree with you.
And, you know, once you have to get over that hump of like, I don't know about this thing. It's right. probably boring, you know, like that right, might be right. your first reaction. But once you know a little bit, all of a sudden it becomes this incredibly fascinating thing with new puzzles and, yeah. you know, mysteries that you can unravel, and you never know where it's going to take you. And so I think that, you know, I'm so glad that I was swayed by that enthusiasm, because I think it really, yeah, you know, helped put me on the right track.
That's very good advice. I'm going to use that, because I totally agree with that, you know, and I'll be at conferences and things with people that are very narrowly just focused on the one thing. They don't really seem to care about things other than that. And then you see other people that are interested in everything. And those are the people I always want to talk to.
Yeah, and, you know, like, and sometimes, you know, we run the risk of being dilettantes, and I try to avoid that to some extent. But it's also one of the privileges of this job is getting to keep thinking about new and exciting things. And I think that
yes.
one of the ways that we make progress in science is by, you know, bringing expertise from one area to another area, because we view things in different ways. Because, you know, you've spent time thinking about this kind of problem, and then somebody presents a new problem to you, like, oh, well, I thought about, you know, this technique, maybe we can apply it in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely. So then you did a postdoc at the Harvard Center for Astrophysics, mm-hmm. and then you were at Boulder,
yeah.
Colorado. But now you've been a faculty at University of Arizona for over a decade now, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Sorry to remind
no,
you.
No, it's true.
But that's great. And so, what do you like the most about your job?
I mean, I think it comes back to what I was just saying, is the flexibility to keep thinking about new and exciting topics. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that's really cool about the University of Arizona is it's this really huge collection of people thinking about astronomy and related topics.
Yes.
There's something like 300 or 400 like technical PhD level scientists in a few blocks in Tucson, right? There's like the University of Arizona has the Department of Astronomy and Stewart Observatory, which mm-hmm. are, you know, very closely related entities. Then there's the Planetary Science and the Lunar and Planetary Lab, which is like a planetary sciences group. Mm-hmm. There's NOIR Lab, which is an ORA, an NSF funded facility that operates telescopes. It also has other scientists there. One of the, you know, leaders in the new Rubin Observatory. There's also a physics department. I'm part of an applied math group as well. And so there's just so many people to talk to about so many different topics. It's like very easy to be continually re-inspired to think about new ideas.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
I hadn't considered how much was in Arizona. But yeah, that's very cool. So let me ask you this. What was in grad school, was your first research project?
The first research project I did was on the stability of disks around young massive stars and trying to understand how they funneled mass to help big stars get really big, and under what conditions the disk going around the massive star might become unstable to its own self-gravity and fragment and break up into little pieces.
Okay. So that's a lot of things at once, but on a very basic level, the idea was young stars, they're just being born, they have a disk around it.
That's right.
Which is basically a lot of your research.
Yeah, yeah, no,
continuing
right.
on. Your first research project is...
It has stayed strong as a continuing theme of trying to understand the growth of stars and the dynamics of the material in orbit around them.
Right. And so in this particular case, you were looking at instabilities in these disks.
That's right. And an instability in the technical sense of somebody who thinks about fluid dynamics is when, if you take a system that is sort of stable or nothing exciting is happening, and you give it a little kick, you give it a little perturbation, does mm-hmm. that perturbation grow or fade into the background again?
Right, right. Does it just kind of wiggle a little bit and then die down, or does it grow up and become, yeah,
exactly.
is it unstable? Is it going to do all kinds of crazy things?
Exactly.
Make some turbulence and stuff like
yes,
that?
Yes, yes.
So these particular systems you were looking at as your first research project, the idea was there may be an instability in these disks.
Yeah, the you know, this is another example of, I think, you know, science at work. So my advisor had worked on this topic in the context of low mass stars. So he had studied how low mass stars grow and what happened in the disks of gas and dust surrounding them as they were trying to funnel mass onto the star.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, oh, I know the answer. If we consider high mass stars, we're going to get the same result. This will be a nice, straightforward, you know, change a couple parameters, give mm-hmm. the graduate student an easy project. And we found, in fact, the opposite, which is that massive stars behaved quite differently.
Oh.
And that because they have to try to grow so fast, they have to accrete material onto them so quickly, because massive stars, basically everything they do is fast. They mm-hmm. have much shorter lives than more massive stars. And so as a consequence, they have to get their mass much more quickly
right.
than you might otherwise expect. And so as a result of trying to drive the mass onto the stars so quickly, it's very hard to keep the disks from being susceptible to these instabilities.
I see.
And so, you know, we ended up finding something quite different from what my advisor had initially expected, and that's kind of what made the project so fun.
Oh, cool. Great. So maybe I should, I think this helps transition us into your general research that you work on now. So here's how I always start, as I ask this question. When you meet a new grad student or fellow scientist, and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
Oh, let's see. I think I have kind of a scattered answer. So I say I work on a variety of problems in theoretical astrophysics related to stars or planets. If I'm talking to, I guess, a less technical person, I say I do the fluid dynamics of space.
Okay.
I work on topics in computational astrophysics, so I'm interested in big computer simulations. More recently, I've taken a total left turn and started thinking about problems related to telescope control systems, oh. which is really not something that I was ever trained to do, but it's been a lot of fun.
Cool.
So, you know, I generally tell, if I'm talking to a, you know, potential new graduate student, I generally tell them I'm pretty flexible and like to think about a lot of different topics in okay. theoretical astrophysics.
But generally, at least I know you as somebody who works on formation of stars and planets.
Yeah.
And in as a theorist and a computational person.
That's right.
Who builds computational models of these growing solar systems and how they get to where they are.
Yes. companions to stars from, you know, at all masses, going down to the smallest planets to the, you know, largest binary stars.
Okay. So then, in general, then, what does that research look like, you know, in terms of your day-to-day research?
I mean, in terms of my day-to-day research, in terms of what am I doing, I'm sitting in front of a computer, and but
I don't mean the parts where you're checking your email. You
know, even when I'm not checking my email,
I know that's a large part of my day, but
you know. I'm still sitting in front of my computer looking at data mm-hmm. coming out of numerical simulations. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of my time actually talking to other scientists in my group about their various projects.
Right. Okay. So, and then another way of saying it is your students, for example, or the people in your research group, what are they doing day to day? Or what do you think they're doing day to day?
So I have one student right now who is mm-hmm. working on a project that's sort of near and dear to my heart that goes back to this thesis, you know, the beginning of my thesis that I was talking about, looking at gravitational instability in disks.
Mm-hmm.
And he's taking a very deep dive into analytic linear modeling of this instability.
Oh, okay.
And so what that means is basically taking the basic equations that describe how a fluid behaves and considering limiting cases where you imagine I'm going to take some system that's described by a set of equations that tell me how fluids behave and how gravity interacts with these fluids and consider what happens to them under small perturbations.
Okay, so, and this is different from what you were just saying previously about computational modeling. This is like pen and paper.
This is in principle pen and paper. This is as close as you can get to pen and paper. We still end up using tools like Mathematica to
right.
solve, you know, high order dispersion relations where, you know, keeping track of all the different terms by hand can be onerous, and we still end up using, you know, numerical methods
right.
to say solve a differential equation, but it's not a big computer simulation where you're still solving the same equations, but you're basically allowing a computer to do a lot of the hard computational work.
Right. So the idea with this, is you start with your model for the disk, which is like what is the density and pressure everywhere, and that's written down by or as some formula.
That's right.
And then you say their equations fluid dynamics say that that should just keep it in orbit nicely, but then if you add a little slight deviation to that condition, to that initial condition, like a little bit of a change in the, like a little velocity perturbation right. or something like that, then you can say, how will that develop over time?
Well, another way of thinking about it is to imagine it like waves in, you know, some tank of water or even waves in the ocean, right? You can imagine a case where there's a wave that just kind of propagates and, you know, bounces around a little bit, nothing very exciting happens. And then you can imagine a wave where under certain circumstances, it starts to grow in amplitude uncontrollably.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to differentiate between. You can also imagine thinking about waves on a string. So if you've ever played the game where, you know, one person holds the end of a rope steady and another person waves their hand up and down, you can create like waves in a rope. And depending on how quickly you wiggle your hand and how big a big wiggle you give it, you can get either little tiny waves that travel back and forth. You can get one big wave. And so in some sense, what we're doing is we're trying to understand what waves are allowed to exist in this given fluid system and what happens to them in time.
Right, right. So it's you're solving the problem in a constrained way, where you're saying you're just asking the question of how do waves propagate in this system,
exactly,
and that way you can solve it with methods that are a little bit I don't know if easier is the right word, but like it's where you're not doing as hard of computation on big supercomputers and things like that.
Right, and it's a way to, you know, you can imagine exploring a wider parameter space, and it's
right.
also a way to really understand in detail the physical mechanisms at play. And so
yes.
one of the things that we've been trying to understand is, you know, this sort of quasi-steady state that we seem to observe in numerical models and maybe in nature as well, that determines how stars accrete. And
okay.
what we're trying to figure out is how is it that I talked about these disks of material around growing stars a little earlier, and what's happening in the process of forming a star is that you have this large scale, what we call a molecular cloud of gas and dust that's turbulent with all these flows, and somewhere in these flows you get a collapse that starts to form a star, and material rains down onto this star, but it has a little bit of angular momentum, and so it forms a rotationally supported disk. It doesn't rain directly down onto one finite point in space. You get this disk.
Yeah.
And then the material continues to flow onto this disk, and then from the disk it flows onto the star.
Yeah.
And one thing that seems to happen, both in simulations and again we think in nature, is that whatever rate material falls onto this disk, whatever rate is supplied by this very large scale structure, is matched by the disk up to a point. So the disk says, okay, how much mass are you giving me? I'm gonna take exactly that amount of mass and I'm gonna transport it down to the star so that I can stay in a quasi-steady state.
Okay.
And it does so by starting to grow these spiral arms. So these are these over densities, and they basically torque the gas and transfer angular momentum, so they spread a little bit of material goes out and a lot of material goes in.
Now these spiral arms, are they from caused by this instability you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. So you can think of them as being, you know, something that starts out as a small perturbation that grows, and it'll look like, if anybody has seen, you know, a picture of a beautiful spiral galaxy.
Right.
It's actually the exact same phenomena, but it's at play in the disks around stars, not just in the
right.
disks of galaxies.
It's the same instability.
It's basically
on
the same,
a totally different scale.
Totally different scale. And you know, the sort of fun fact is that even though the galaxies are actually composed of a disk of stars, which isn't exactly a fluid,
right.
you can apply basically the same equations in a lot of instances, and that's why the phenomena are so similar. But the thing we see in the case of stars is that, again, these spiral arms, they grow to just the right amplitude mm-hmm. to transport just the right amount of mass so that it can process the material coming in and sort of be a star-making factory that doesn't break up into a million pieces or, you know, disappear entirely.
So it somehow regulates the
exactly.
accretion.
Yeah, in the words of the linear theory, we call it this, somehow there's a saturation of the instability, and that's mm-hmm. the thing we've been kind of trying to understand. And the way that we're trying to get at that is through these simpler models, because when you run a numerical simulation, there's always a lot going on.
Right.
And it can be very hard to understand, what physical mechanism is controlling the output that you observe. It's really good for showing you maybe what the answer might be, but it's not so good for showing you why that's the correct answer.
I'm going to pause and just clarify the phrase numerical simulation, meaning, because I'm very comfortable with that phrase, but it may be, when my parents are listening, they might not know. So the idea being you have the numerical simulation being like you put it, the whole thing on a computer, in the sense you have a big grid and you say at this point the density is this much and this point the pressure is this much, and you're just tracking everything and that way you're seeing everything that happens.
Yeah, so imagine you're sitting in your car right now, or you're sitting in a room and there's some air in the room, mm-hmm. right? I could break up the air into a bunch of different pieces, and then I could write down equations that tell me how the air is moving from one side of the room to the other based on, the temperature in the room right now, the density of the air in the room, mm-hmm. whether or not you've got a fan on one side or not, mm-hmm. Whether or not you've got a window open. And I have some set of equations that tell me how the air is going to move. And I'm going to describe the air at all these different points in my room. I'm going to give the computer a set of equations and say, okay, I want you to use these equations to tell me how the air is going to move from one, location in the room to the next in time. And I'm mm-hmm. just going to keep going forward one step at a time
right.
in time and see how the air moves. And that's right. exactly the same thing we're doing when we solve these kind of problems in astrophysics, except instead of describing the air in the room, we're describing, a star or a cloud of gas and dust in space that's collapsing to form a star.
Right. Okay. And so then we're drawing a distinction between doing something like that, which basically tells you everything that will happen, but doesn't necessarily tell you why it happens.
Right. it's harder to turn on and off different, different terms in an equation in right. that kind of model, in the same way that we have control over it when we write down a series of equations and say, well, what if I think that, if I write down an equation that's AX plus BX squared plus CX cubed, where each of those ABCs are some number, and then there's some variable X, which is, say, the speed that the air is moving. Mm-hmm. I can say, well, what happens if I make one of those terms A go to zero? Mm-hmm. Okay, what happens if I make the next term B go to zero?
Right.
And then I can understand the contributions from each of those different pieces in a way that's harder to see in a big numerical simulation.
Right, right, right. Right. And okay, so that's a good way of thinking about it. So then, okay, let's remind ourselves of what we're talking about. We were talking about trying to understand these disks that are with instabilities and they're accreting, that are processing gas basically from this molecular cloud.
Exactly, yeah.
Onto a protostar, and that they seem to regulate. So okay, so that's an example of a research problem that, yeah, that your student's working
one
on.
One student is working on. Yeah, that's right.
And so I guess one of the answers to the question of what does the data research look like, it can look like many things, right? Because that was an example of, doing a calculation, we call it analytically, right? Or semi-analytically.
Right.
But then you also do these big numerical simulations as well.
Yeah, so later in the day I'll have a meeting with, another set of students or students in postdocs who are working on a, large-scale numerical simulation like we mm-hmm. just described, where let's say we're trying to understand how a giant planet grows inside one of these same kind of disks. So the disk might be still getting mass from the star-forming environment, from these big molecular clouds. It might still be feeding material onto the star that's growing, but at the same time, that's not all. There's also a planet trying to grow in this disk. And one of the cool things, we've learned in astronomy in the last couple decades is that planets are probably more common than stars in the galaxy. So there's, it's not the case that every star is going to have a planet, But on average, there's going to be more than one planet per star.
Right.
And so these things are very abundant. They must be forming.
Yeah.
And we're still trying to understand exactly how that happens.
And Mara was just telling me when I had her on that basically they're there in the even the earliest stages, like very, very early, like first, I don't know, even like 10,000 years. I don't remember.
Yeah, 100,000 to a million years, let's say. Yeah.
But even, she was talking about a system she had observed that was very, like the youngest one we had seen, and that one had evidence for planets in it.
That's
and
right.
So, like,
yeah.
And so anyway, the point is like they're around affecting the system at this early, even these very early stages.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so we're trying to understand, you know, one of the big things our group has been working on is trying to understand these two processes together. So trying to understand both how the planet grows while the star is still growing, because people used to think that, you know, people used to think that, oh, first you form the star and you've got this little bit of leftover stuff that's orbiting around, and then that turns into planets. And mm-hmm. it seems like the observations, and frankly also the theory, tells us that that can't be the whole story, that the planets really have to start growing almost right after the star starts to accrete.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means that the environment in which these planets are growing is a little more complicated and dynamic than we might have expected 10, 20 years ago.
Right.
And so in order to tackle that kind of problem, we have to develop these very, I think, neat numerical tricks
mm-hmm.
that allow us to both study large-scale structures and small-scale structures in the same simulation at the same time. And what that, you can think of that as, you know, I talked about, oh, how we were trying to study the air in this room.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, you want to study the whole room, but at the same time you're trying to study the room, you're also trying to study what's happening to a tiny dust, you know, dust grain that's floating through the breeze that you might see when the sun shines in your window, right?
Right.
You want to resolve how that dust grain is interacting with the air while you're also studying all the air in the room.
Yeah.
And covering that range of scales is a real challenge.
Yes.
But with, you know, modern computation, you know, we're actually able to do that now, which is pretty cool.
So the problem we were just talking about was planets interacting with a forming disk,
mm-hmm.
And what is the type of stuff you're trying to learn from that?
So one of the things we're trying to explain both why we get planets with the range of masses that we see. So why do we get some planets that grow into things that look like Jupiter, and why do other planets stop at, you know, a mass like Earth or
right.
Neptune? And, you know, why do some planets end up, the same question, why do some planets end up with this big atmosphere of gas like
right.
Jupiter, and why do some stay rocky?
Right.
And we're trying to understand where those different planets might form, and whether or not there's a relationship between the kind of planet that forms and where it forms in the disk. Does it form close to the star? Does it form far away from the star?
Right.
And
the problem was so simple before we discovered exoplanets.
That's
because
right.
Because we said all the planets we knew about were our solar system. So we said little planets form on the inside, big planets form on the outside. That's how it works.
Right. Yeah.
And now that's like systems don't generically at all look like that.
That yeah. Our solar system, you know, is not probably terribly unique in the sense that it's not a weird oddball.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's hard to say that it's very weird, but at the same time, it is not representative of most planetary systems.
Right.
So it's not the
you
case
can,
that they all look the same as our solar system.
Right. It's easy to read too much into, like, if you, like, you know, try to understand the root, like, there's some kind of numerology of rules of the planets
Bode's
obey.
Law, yeah.
Yeah. Like, because you stare at one solar system for a long time, you just kind of convince yourself there are these rules.
Right. Right. But, and it's a good model. I
yes.
mean, it wasn't, and there are many aspects of the model for solar system formation that inform and, you know, inform our models of exoplanets. So
mm-hmm.
it's not that people
oh, sure.
were totally
yes.
off base, but there's basically more variety in nature than we could have ever dreamed of from just looking in at our own solar system.
And our best data will always be in our solar system. So, like, it's not, I mean, in terms of, you know, like, knowing where the asteroids are and
that's,
where the,
that's,
you know,
right.
Like,
I mean, and one of the things I work on is trying to understand where the, you know, where are the dust and rocks in these growing systems compared to the gas.
So you're really hooked on dust
now. Yeah, I'm really hooked. Well, you know, I like to describe dust and rocks as sort of like the dark matter of star and planet formation, because so as you were just saying, in our solar system, right, we can see asteroids and these other things called Kuiper belt objects or comets, these rocky bodies, because they are reflecting a little bit of light from the sun.
Right.
They're pretty faint.
Yeah.
But they're nearby in an astronomical sense.
Right.
So we can see them. If you go to a system that's forming planets around any other star in the universe, all of those things are invisible.
Right.
Because they don't emit their own light very efficiently, and the light they reflect from their own star is way too faint for us to ever see. They just don't really glow. And so we are, but those things, those rocky bodies, those are what make up the planets.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not talking about a gas giant like Jupiter, but you wanted to say understand Earth, you don't really care where all of the gas is. And remember, the gas in the universe is 99% of the mass.
Right.
But that's not making up Earth. Earth is basically 99% the other stuff.
Right.
So, but that makes up, that's, so you're trying to take the 1% of the stuff and figure out how it makes, you know, Earth and everything that we, you know and love and interact with every day. And that's, but it all starts out as dust. And so you got to figure out how those dust grains grow into the rocks that you can't see. And, you know, how you get something like us.
Well, that's a very good that's a very good case you make for dust, because that's a good point. Is that like in a solar system, that's where, you know, most of the mass goes into the star and the gaseous planets, but then you have these rocky planets that we really like as a society.
It turns out,
the best school districts.
That's right.
And but yeah, that's where that all comes from, dust. So that's very interesting. So let me see. Let me ask you, is there any sort of big recent result you're excited about?
So we have a result out this week in Nature Astronomy on binary star formation, which tells us something that I think we had kind of thought for a long time but hadn't really proved, which is that binary stars are born bound to each other. So what does that mean? So we talked a little bit about how stars form in these clouds of gas and dust that are floating around the galaxy. And you know, as all scientists, we often like to consider the simplest model possible.
Right.
We like things that are spherically symmetric. You know, we can only think about one. We can think about only one dimension.
Yeah.
And so we have all these models of star formation where you think about how a blob of gas turns into one star sitting by itself, not interacting with anything.
Right.
Now, when we look out into the sky in our galaxy at real stars, we find that a very large fraction of them don't just have planets around them, but they're orbited by another stellar companion.
Right.
And what we've shown, and again, this is using very large-scale numerical simulations, is that those stars that we see most of the time were born at the same time together.
Okay.
So if I look at the time that one star formed in some binary system, and I look at the time another star formed, it'll be almost at exactly the same time. And at the moment they first exist, they're already bound to each other gravitationally.
Okay. So just to clarify, like the alternative would be, for example, one forming and then maybe another star forming out of the material that was falling in the disk, or maybe getting captured at a later time.
Yeah. I think so. In the case where one formed out of the disk, they would start out their lives bound as well, right?
Okay.
It would be in orbit, so that would count, I think, in the same model.
Enough.
But the other idea is that they form kind of far away from each other. They're doing on their own thing, and then they fly by each other and get caught.
Right.
And that's not what we see happening.
I didn't realize that there was progress in understanding the difference between, because I always hoped they were born at the same time, because that makes my life simpler.
That's the thing. It's one of these things where people, you know, we talk about, oh, how do you form binary stars? Oh, well, you get these two blobs and they are near each other, I guess, and then
somehow they decide to
be in orbit.
Get together.
But I think the thing that's worth pointing out is a lot of these stars, they form on very at very different separations than we find them today. So if I look out into the sky at the typical binary star system with a mass that's kind of like our own sun, it'll have a stellar companion kind of in the Kuiper belt at that distance. So 40 times the separation between the Earth and the Sun. That's kind of the typical place where you'll find a binary. Now, there's a wide range of possible separations, but that's the typical location.
Right.
When they start out, these stars can be thousands of AU apart. So 1,000 times the Earth-Sun distance or more. But they're not random, right? They start out, they know about each other, they're falling towards each other, and their orbit just evolves very rapidly to be something like the things we observe at later times.
Okay. And so how were you able to see that this was the case, to show that this was the case?
So I'd say the big breakthrough came from two different things. One was having a large enough set of examples in terms of simulations of forming binaries that we had really good statistics. So if you do, if you simulate enough stars, then you can say what happens.
So basically start from the collapsing cloud and see what sorts of systems form out of those.
Yeah, exactly. So we start from a big collapsing cloud and put in, you know, sort of as much of the physics as we can that we think is needed. So that means we study not just how the gas and dust move, not just the effect of gravity, but we also include radiation.
Right.
So how does the fact that the stars are glowing and heating the gas change things?
Right.
We include feedback in the form of outflows.
Yeah.
So that means that as stars are getting material accreted onto them, they also launch these jets of material that shoot back out into the cloud
Very
and create extra turbulence and we put in magnetic fields, you know, like kind of the whole, you know, everything we can think of. And then we make the box really, really big, or we do a couple different boxes of these, you know, forming stars. And then we look at all the cases where you end up forming these two objects that, you know, end up orbiting each other 10 million years later. And then we ask, well, where were they when they were born? And we say, we also try to ask, okay, are they, to determine whether or not they're gravitationally bound to each other, we take into account not just the newborn baby star that exists, that's maybe a tiny fraction of the mass that it's going to be at the end of its accretion time. We also take into account the gas that's already bound to it. So when you form a star, both in a simulation and in reality, the star doesn't just come into existence with its final mass, just like babies aren't born as, you know, 200-pound men, right? They're like, they start out little and they get bigger and bigger. Stars are the same way. But stars, for the most part, you can kind of see a lot of the stuff that they're going to grow from even when they're born.
Right.
So imagine if like a person was born and like all around them was all the food they were ever going to eat for the next 18 years, right? That's the way stars are. You can kind of, not all of it, you know, there's some, you know, McDonald's that you pass along the way maybe, but you see all that stuff and you say, okay, if I want to determine, and that stuff is already in orbit, it's like bound to the star.
Right.
So it's all like some, you know.
So you say what mass this star will have.
Yeah. Well, you might not be able to, you might not be able to predict it exactly, but you can say, okay, here's this blob of stuff and it's all kind of collapsing down to a point. And right now the star maybe only has, you know, a tiny fraction of the mass like already turned into star that it's going to ever have. But if I take into account that it's bound to this whole blob of stuff, I can ask, well, is this blob of stuff bound to this other blob of stuff? And the answer is basically yes.
Okay.
And it's not just, you know, you can actually see it in the way that they're moving relative to one another because they're kind of crashing towards each other. So they're clearly interacting gravitationally even from the moment that they're born.
Right. So this shows sort of demonstrates one of the nice things about doing this in a simulation is you can, you know, track, you can see what the outcome is at the end, and you can actually ask, where did this start out from? You can track the whole process.
That's right.
Whereas when you're looking at these systems, you can look at stars that are in binaries, you know, billions of years later, or you can look at stars that are currently forming, but you don't get to watch the evolution.
Exactly. And, you know, one of the things that is tricky about studying star formation versus, say, the statistics of stars is that, right, stars live for billions of years.
Right.
So they spend a lot of time as stars doing very little. But by contrast, star formation happens in less than a million years.
Right.
Right. So that's many orders of magnitude less time.
Yes.
Right. 3 to 4 orders of magnitude less time. So that means that you don't have a chance to observe as many instances of the process forming, and you don't see all the different steps as easily.
Right.
Because you don't have enough examples to see, like, okay, here's what it looked like at a million years. Here's what it looks like 20,000 years later. Here's what it looks like 50,000 years later.
Right, right, right.
And so trying to infer that can be difficult. And so our best bet is to try to look at all the different time snapshots that we can in one of these numerical simulations, and then we try to map that onto what we see both at early times when we look at regions that are forming stars, and at late times when we look at the stars that have actually formed.
Okay, so then is the idea that you, by doing this, you can basically account for existing binary systems purely from, or at least, or maybe, yeah, maybe it's, I don't know which the right way to say it. Is it that you can account for this binary systems we see purely by systems that formed together at the same time, and so you don't need them to capture? Or is it even more than that, where you say, like, they just, you don't really get captures, what you get is the two stars forming at the same time?
Yeah, so it's not that never happens, right? So there are cases, there are cases where you'll say you'll form a pair of stars together, and then they'll undergo some encounter with a third star or two more stars, and they'll do a complicated little dynamical gravitational dance, and you know, you'll have some partner exchanges, and so you'll kick out one guy and end up with a different partner than you went in with. So that still happens. We can just now quantify what fraction of systems we expect to have come from these guys started their lives together and they're going to end their lives together, and what fraction underwent one of these kind of dances. And the other kind of, I think, pretty cool outcome is that we found that something like 40% of stars that are now, of low mass stars that are now by themselves. Mm-hmm. So you look out today and you see a single star, 40% of those probably were born in a binary.
Really?
And so the idea that, you know, any given star really was formed in isolation, you got to be really careful with that assumption.
So it could, our sun could have been formed in a binary?
Our sun could have been formed in a binary. Okay. And I'm not going to go out and I'm not going to say, oh, we have evidence for that. I don't think that's the case. I want to be very clear. I am not arguing for Planet Nine was formed by an interaction with a formerly bound binary companion, but it is totally within in the realm of possibility just based on the mass of our sun.
Right. And okay, that's very cool. And so then generically, if I look out at and see a binary star system, generically the expectation is that those two formed at the same time.
That's right. They formed at the same time and they formed bound together.
Wow. That's cool. That's great. So let me ask you then, I think we've covered a lot of stuff. So why don't I ask you this penultimate question, which is, in your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics?
Oh, that's a good one. So I'd say there's a couple reasons. One, I think classic example is if you count general relativity as sort of an astrophysics topic.
Mm-hmm. I do.
Okay, great. Then you really never know what's going to become useful, right? Mm-hmm. So the best example, I like general relativity as an example because, of course, everybody now uses maps on their phone.
Right.
Maps rely on GPS. So if you want to navigate, you know, to any given location, you want to find a new restaurant, pull up your phone, you want to use GPS. GPS only works if you put in gravitational, the corrections from general relativity. Otherwise, your accuracy is terrible. So I don't think anybody who was coming up with a theory of general relativity could have predicted that it would have been very useful for finding the nearby Starbucks, but turns out it is. And so as with all basic research topics, it's very hard to predict a priori which things are going to lead to some transformational new technology. And so I think astrophysics has the ability to play that role.
Absolutely.
Both in terms of basic topics and in terms of technique development.
Yeah.
You know, one of the fun things about being involved in an applied math program is I get to talk to people who are doing things like studying flows of, you know, fluids through veins.
Right.
And they're doing it for something that, you know, directly matters, like predicting heart attacks or predicting strokes. But some of the exact same techniques that we developed to study growing planets can actually be used to study flows in veins that could help you, you know, figure out what's going to happen, you know, to this patient who's going to have a heart attack or might not have a heart attack or might have a stroke or might need this intervention or that intervention. And so there's lots of ways for useful technology crossover. And then there's, you know, the philosophical point that at some level we like to understand where we came from, why Earth is here, why, you know, are we special? And those are the kind of questions that only astrophysics can answer.
Good. Okay. So then what, I'll finally finish off by asking, what is sort of the next, what are the next big things you're excited about for the future, either in your field or generally in astrophysics?
So the kind of side topic that I've been working on is trying to deploy machine learning models on various areas of astrophysics. This is a hot new area. I've been particularly focused on telescope control systems, meaning trying to make telescopes operate more efficiently and more accurately using, you know, these data-hungry machine learning models, because it's an area that I think is really ripe for improvement.
Oh, so you mean like for in terms of like deciding what to point the telescope at?
Not even just deciding, well, it could be deciding what to point the telescope at, but more trying to figure out how to point the telescope accurately and efficiently. So suppose I want to observe, let's say I want to observe, you know, there's a couple cases. Let's say I want to observe 30 targets tonight. That's a pretty ambitious goal. there's an optimal order to do it in.
Yes, yeah.
And machine learning can help you with that.
But it is funny that we still just have people just coming up with their own like the lists and like just kind of making me like, wait, and then I'll look at this and then I'll look at that.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, and the other big problem that I think people don't know about is that actually getting a telescope to point to a specific place in the sky is pretty hard.
Yeah.
There are these, you know, multi-ton giant pieces of machinery, and you're trying to get them to focus on a spot in the sky that's, you know, a 30th of the diameter of the moon, or, you know, much less than that, let's say, you know, a 1,000th of the diameter of the moon, and now you want to follow it as it moves across the sky. And that is, it turns out, a hard problem that people have done a pretty darn good job of solving, given how hard it is.
Yes.
But it takes a lot of time to get that at the accuracy. And I think we can do better with machine learning models than we, you know, actually we've shown we were able to now do better with machine learning models than we were able to do with these traditional methods. And I think this is going to become more important as we get these bigger and more complicated telescopes, is having smart ways to ingest the data that we're taking every night and turning it into a way to improve the operation of the telescope itself.
Oh, absolutely. Especially, I mean, every minute of telescope time they're spending lots of taxpayer money, potentially. And so, you know, optimally using that is in everyone's best interest.
It's you know, we have a lot of older telescopes that, you know, people invested a lot of money in, but they are, you know, like a car, right? They get old and dated. And if there's a way to make your car operate better and, you know, make it work for longer, that's what you want to do. And so that's the other thing that these kind of models, I think, have the power to do, is to take an older machine and help it operate, you know, closer to its original efficiency, or maybe even better than its original efficiency, by improving it and not just having some telescope operator sitting there, you know, hitting arrow keys trying to make it work, which is often what happens,
because
we don't have a better system yet.
Right. All right. And with that, I think we're done. So thank you very much, Dr. Kreider, for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
A lot of fun talking science with you, and I hope you'll join me again sometime.
Sounds great.
Once again, Dr. Caitlin Kreider demonstrated the extreme depth and breadth of her astrophysics knowledge, and as amazing as it can be to hear about the latest observations of exoplanets and newly formed solar systems, it is sometimes even more impressive to talk with a theorist about the tremendous work it takes to build an interpretation for these observations. So thank you again to Dr. Kreider, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. Music on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford. You can find it on her album, Trotter. All songs were used with permission from the artist and producer. Look her up if you enjoyed the music. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana, by me, Paul Duffel, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Purdue University. Wow, that was a lot of astrophysics. It's so interesting to think about a star becoming a white dwarf, but then later on, it can still interact with its own solar system, and we can even see it eat up all that rocky debris long after it's condensed into this compact object. So thank you again to Dr. Tim Cunningham, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. The Astrophysics Podcast is currently unfunded, but always ad-free. The music you hear on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford from her album Trotter. All songs are used with permission from the artist and producer. Look up Britton Ashford if you enjoyed the music. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana by me, Paul Duffel, professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University.